Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And joining me this week is Dr. Suze Kundu, a nanochemist and teaching fellow at the University of Surrey. Her research focuses on capturing the energy from sunlight and passing that energy to water molecules, a reaction you may recognise from the humble leaf and better known as artificial photosynthesis. As well as her research, Suze is also a highly respected science communicator, sharing her love for chemistry, physics and materials science in live lectures, television shows and on the radio. She once said, "The world around us is made of stuff. From a very early age, I have been fascinated by this stuff, often breaking things apart to try and figure out how everything works. Luckily, science has enabled me to turn this destructive curiosity into a career." Good morning, Suze.
Good morning, Matilda. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I mean, it's bitterly cold outside,
so
I'm
so cold.
Very glad to be in our warm, warm studio.
I'm quite grateful it is so cozy in here, actually.
I've also noticed you're wearing a Christmas jumper.
I am wearing a Christmas jumper. It's a nerdy Christmas jumper. It's just an excuse, really. I got one for my fiancé and one for me. They're diehard Christmas jumpers because I'm rapidly coming around to the fact that Die Hard may be the greatest Christmas movie ever made.
Is it actually made at Christmas? I have to confess, I've never seen it.
Yes. Oh, do you know what I would recommend? And I would not have said that 3 years ago. It genuinely is surprisingly festive and cheerful in a very strange way. It's set around Christmas in California. And I think, you know, the following diehards, they might all be set around Christmas. I'm not sure. Apparently, I've seen another two of them. I don't remember. But yeah, the first one, definitely. It's certainly Christmas themed, albeit in California.
Now, I want to ask you more about this destructive curiosity. What sort of things did you break apart?
Effectively, as soon as I was tall enough to reach things, I would try and find out how they worked. So if that was my dad's vinyl turntable, I found it fascinating that these big, round, flat things could be put onto something and a needle just traced the shape around them and made this noise. So as soon as I could grab it, I took the turntable needle apart. And I remember a very sort of shame-faced trip to a very specialist shop to go and replace the needle because they were really expensive.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. And then I remember my mum just sort of saying, "What do you do with your Barbie dolls?" Because I pull them apart to try and find out how they
take
worked.
Off their arms and
arms,
things.
Arms, heads. So just like limbs in one room, heads in another. So luckily, you know, I haven't gone into medicine.
Categorising.
Thank
like
goodness.
Any good scientist.
Absolutely, yeah. So yeah, not a career in medicine for me, thankfully. But material science is destructive enough for my liking.
So our brain teaser for you this morning, I'm just going to read it because poor producer Miriam is stuck on a Piccadilly line crisis. So I'm going to say good morning, science mixers, on her behalf. And today's brain teaser, should you wish to take part, what is the thinnest material in the world? So more of a trivia question than a riddle. But what is the thinnest material in the world? If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape. And for our experiment this week, I'm super excited because it's a really fun one. And it should be great to try over Christmas. If you want to get involved, all you need is some corn flour, water, Tupperware, and a wooden spoon. Now, Suze, back to you and your mixtape. What is your first song and why?
I thought we would start with something that's going to get everyone moving, get everyone pogoing around their living rooms or their kitchens as they make their lovely breakfasts. So I want to go for Green Day's American Idiot. I love the fact that they're a punk band I really loved when I was little. And I love the fact that they've always been quite vocal in their opinions and in sort of sharing states of the world at the moment. I guess the reason I've chosen this one is because this song was relevant a decade ago. And sadly, it seems to be quite relevant yet again. So that's why I've chosen this one.
America. Welcome to a new kind of tension all across the alien mission.
The word nano is from the Greek word nanos, meaning dwarf. It is a prefix used to describe 1/1,000,000,000th of something.
Miriam has made it to the studio in time for her first nanoscience fact. Well done, an impressive feat. So, Suze, you work in artificial photosynthesis, but that's actually a form of nanochemistry. I think we've heard of nanoscience, but not many of us have heard of nanochemistry. So what does it mean to be a nanochemist?
Amusingly, not that this translates very well into radio, but I say a nanochemist literally and professionally. So I work on tiny science and I am also a very tiny scientist. So I'm not just far away. I used to be 6'4", but it wasn't very on brand. So I'm now very small. I'm a grand height of 4'10", if we push it.
Wow.
Yeah, let's say 10. And so what I actually work on, yes, is a nanomaterial. So it's a nanocrystalline material. But nanoscience itself, I think people think of it as being quite a futuristic area of research. It's actually not. It's been around for millions of years in nature. So for something to be a nanomaterial, it has to fall within the nanometer dimension. So a nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. We're talking really tiny. So it's 10^-9 meters.
Wow.
And you can't see that, obviously. So what we work on is any kind of material that can work around that scale. Now, the reason being that when something is in a much larger form, it obeys the classic laws of physics and mechanics. So the big forces that we're subject to, that we respond to. Whereas on that tiny scale, all the rules go out the window and things start to misbehave. So they obey a whole different law of physics and mechanics. It sort of tends towards quantum mechanics, where things start to get really quite strange. As a material scientist, what we do is we try and harness those weird properties and we find really cool ways of using them. So, for example, with the work I'm doing, it is inspired by nature, but there's nanotechnology all around us in nature, from the weird effect of water on lotus leaves, which is all down to the sort of
when you see them kind of like being a little ball and kind of the leaf is sort of repelling the water.
Exactly. So it doesn't even sort of like just resist it. It really repels it to the point where the water beads up into these tiny balls. So the contact area of that water droplet onto the material is so small. So it's known as super hydrophobicity. So if you break it down, phobic is really hating, hydro is water, and super means very. It really hates water, and it's all down to the nano and micro structure of these lotus leaves. So they're very, very spiky, and the water just doesn't have a chance to really wet that material
to really kind of bond with it, because the spikes are pushing it away.
Yeah, exactly. So
you wouldn't think when you touch them they don't feel spiky.
They don't at all. But I mean, obviously you can't really experience this unless you're in Kew Gardens or something, you know, who has a lotus leaf lying around. But brilliantly, you can see it on things like cabbage and broccoli as well. So it's very much a do try this at home situation. Wet a normal surface and then wet something like a broccoli floret and see the difference in the water. You can actually sometimes get water, tiny water droplets, to bounce off the surface of them because they're just so repellent.
Wow. Yeah. Oh my God, I'm going to go home and try that for lunch.
Broccoli has never been so exciting.
I love the idea that it's that actually nanoscience is in nature all around us, because I think it's become quite a buzzword in the sort of the recent decade. Mm. It's like, oh, it's going to allow us to have nanobots in our body and do all this like cool, amazing stuff on the nano scale. And yeah, I actually hadn't thought about the fact that it's been there forever.
Well, even nanobots. I mean, when we think about nanobots in the sense that we expect them to exist, these tiny machines, we effectively do already have them. They're viruses. So what we're trying to do, you know, amazing bioengineers are trying to do, are engineer these viruses so that they can work for good and not for evil. Mm. So they can actually do stuff to heal us and help us rather than cause damage. Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a good way of putting it.
It's awesome.
So talking about copying nature, you are trying to mimic the leaf. Ooh. So tell me more about that. What does your work on artificial photosynthesis involve?
Photosynthesis is the way that plants make their own food, because they can't chomp on things like we can. So they make glucose, and that's what they use to feed them. And they do that by combining carbon dioxide and sunlight, effectively. Sunlight is what drives that reaction. So that's where they're getting their energy from, and they're transferring that solar energy into a chemical fuel for them. Mm. What we're trying to do is not make glucose, but we are trying to make hydrogen. So we're isolating a very small area of the photosynthetic process. Photosynthesis.
So is it kind of like an earlier step on the way to glucose?
Yeah, effectively. So photosynthesis is split into two systems. So there's photosystem one and photosystem two. And within photosystem two, you have this section where these chlorophyll molecules, so these
That's
pigmented,
the thing that makes it green.
Exactly. So I think there are a couple of different ones that you get within a leaf. So one of these chlorophyll molecules will be able to capture a sort of packet of energy coming from the sun, a photon of light. Now, it has to be of a specific energy in order for the next stage to happen. So if it is of a certain energy, it's absorbed by the chlorophyll, and an electron, a charged particle, is photogenerated. So it gets excited and it's able to do stuff then. So it starts to kind of conduct, and it can go on to reduce water. So water...
What do you mean when you say reduce water?
So you have, if you go back to sort of classic...
Not boil it off
GCSE
in the cooking
GCSE chemistry. No, not quite. So you have oxidation and reduction. So it's just two different forms of a similar kind of reaction, competing reactions effectively. Uh-huh. So to reduce something, you're using a negatively charged particle to make something happen. So when we reduce water, we get hydrogen. And when we oxidize water, we get oxygen. So water is made of H2O, two uh-huh. lots of hydrogen to one lots of oxygen. And so what we're trying to do is reduce that water to make hydrogen, to collect it and use it as a fuel. So the plant sort of goes on to use the charged species that it makes from the water quite differently. What we're trying to do is isolate just that part. Now, we're not using chlorophyll to do that, but we're trying to create materials that can do that as efficiently as possible. The reason being, if we can generate lots of hydrogen and we can make it cheap and viable, we have a really clean fuel on our hands, because when you burn hydrogen, you're just recombining it with oxygen, so you get water again. So start with water, end with water. It's a lovely vehicle for solar energy. And obviously we're trying to move away from fossil fuels because they're polluting and they're finite, and goodness me, are they expensive. As a woman that has a car in London, I don't know why I do. I just insure the thing again, thinking I never drive it. But you know, it's really important that we do start to look at alternatives that are going to be truly viable, not just contribute a small amount to, you know, the national grid, to really make a difference,
but to be able to almost replace what we're using currently.
Yeah,
and also photosynthesis takes in carbon dioxide, doesn't it, and gives out oxygen, so it'd be a way of using up all of this carbon dioxide we're producing.
Yeah, so the thing I'm doing doesn't do that. So the materials that I use actually just work with water, but there are loads of sort of ways that we can start to harness the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and even go on to produce things like methane. So obviously you think, well, methane, but you burn that and then you get carbon dioxide again. But the thing is that the carbon dioxide has been taken from the atmosphere in the first place rather than being dug up from fossil fuels.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a complete cycle.
Exactly, yeah.
Not so adding, we're not, and you're not adding, taking away.
Exactly, yeah. So overall, the kind of the balance remains.
We are going to talk about more about this later in the show, but it's time for your second song. So what have you chosen and why?
So I thought I would keep it pretty upbeat at the moment, and I thought I would go for Everlong by the Foo Fighters for the purely selfish reason that it is just one of my top three favourite songs ever by one of my favourite bands. Come down and waste away with me.
One nanometer is about 8 times the radius of an atom and 100 times smaller than a bacterial cell.
Now it's the part that I've been really looking forward to. We are going to make something called oobleck. sounds like a made-up word, probably is. So we need corn flour and water. A Tupperware is best because or some kind of mixing bowl if you're at home, but something that's not going to break and is able to be mixed in. And a wooden spoon, although today in the studio I forgot my wooden spoon, so we are using the end of a toothbrush and the end of a Sharpie pen. Right, Suze, talk me through this. What do I need to do? Because it can be difficult to get the perfect quantities and texture content.
Definitely. So the first thing you need to do is get a rough mixture of about 2 parts corn flour to 1 part water. And you need to try and mix these together as best as possible. So I tend to put the corn flour in first.
Okay.
And then add the water.
So I've got 1 cup of corn flour going in. Going to pour myself another one quickly.
As you do that, I would just like to remind people that obviously corn flour, when it is in the air, can be very flammable. So please be careful. Make sure you're doing this in a well-ventilated area with no sources of ignition.
Okay. And also, I mean, I recommend on a tablecloth or we've got some newspaper because corn flour likes to go everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's like fake snow in the studio. Mm. Okay.
Though the great thing is it'll hoover straight up.
Yeah, exactly. It's not hard to get rid of.
Yeah,
okay, so now I'm putting my water into. So I've got. I'm just using a cup to measure. I'm not even sort of using a measuring jug or anything.
Oh, that is all you need.
Yes.
That is all you need. So pouring the water over. Now, what you want to do is just start quite slowly trying to stir that corn flour into the water that you have added to it.
Okay.
And it is pretty tricky because some of the corn flour will want to clump, some of it will just want to sit on the surface.
It feels like kind of weird solid rocks almost.
Yeah. So this is the kind of thing that we're trying to get to. You should get to a consistency where it looks like a liquid and it behaves like a liquid if you run the end of your Sharpie through it quite slowly. But if you start to stir it a little more vigorously, it will get pretty difficult.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Some parts feel like cement, but the top just looks like water. So
yep.
It's crazy.
So that's one of the weird properties that this stuff displays.
Oh, wow. So we have, I think, as we have one that you've mixed up earlier as well.
Yes.
Which you're going to demonstrate some of the interesting properties around this changing consistency according to speed and force, right?
Yeah, definitely. So what we have here, as I precariously balance this on my knees, because, you know, that's sensible in a studio. So we should be able to see, if you can see, and if you are trying this at home, which I absolutely recommend that you do, perhaps as you're making your Christmas gravy, get some corn flour, mix it with some water, play around with it, is that it very much does look like a liquid. So I can move the highly technical scientific instrument of the end of a toothbrush through it with some ease. I can pick some up onto the end of the toothbrush and it flows quite well. However, if I put it onto this makeshift table here and I hit it quite hard, you should be able to see that the toothbrush just bounces straight off. That's very noisy, isn't it? It bounces straight off the surface. So even though it is behaving like a liquid, and you can see that you can really sort of push the toothbrush through it and it will flow and it will drip on a very sort of sharp impact, it won't do that.
Oh my God.
It'll actually bounce off.
I can really feel that.
Yeah.
It's like I'm hitting a giant rubber.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not, I can't get it to the bottom.
Whereas if you were to sink it in very, very slowly, you'd have no problem.
Yeah.
So what this is demonstrating...
Oh my God, that's crazy. I'm sinking it slowly and now I'm on the bottom and I hit it and it's like hitting a rubber, it bounces back.
So one thing you can do if you are feeling braver at home and you don't have a radio show to run like Matilda does, you can actually just slowly sink your hand to the bottom of it and then very quickly try and pull it up. And the particles effectively lock around your hand and they prevent you from doing so. So you should be able to actually lift the entire tray up that you've made it in just by doing that as you try and take it out very, very quickly.
Oh, wow.
So what it's displaying is a non-Newtonian property. So we follow the laws of Newtonian mechanics, things like water. So the water that we put into this follows Newtonian mechanics in that it doesn't get any thicker or thinner as you apply any force to it.
Yeah.
But some materials do. So this corn flour is demonstrating the property whereby when a force acts upon it, the particles sort of lock together. And for the moment that the force is acting upon it, it behaves more like a solid. So this is why we can bounce the end of the toothbrush off it. This is why your Sharpie is sort of hitting it and it feels rubbery. But then as you sink it down slowly, slowly, when there's a much smaller force, the particles can kind of move past one another and allow for the end of your Sharpie to reach the bottom.
That's so
it's really, really weird. There are materials that do the opposite. So they get runnier when you apply a force to them. So the age old, you know, ketchup in a bottle thing, is it going to be any quicker if I hit the bottom of it? Yes, it actually
really?
Is.
Really? So ketchup has these non-Newtonian principles the other way around?
Exactly. So rather than getting thicker, it does get runnier each time you bash the end of that bottle. So you do get your ketchup onto your chips quicker by putting a bit of effort into it, which I think is awesome. Blood does the same thing as well. Quicksand even. So you've got to be, if you're in quicksand and you struggle, you're actually going to make the quicksand around you more liquefied and runnier.
And that's why you sink.
Exactly. So what you need to do is just chill out, and you will, because you are less dense than the water in the quicksand, you will eventually just float up to the top if you just chill out in it. Treat it as a spa treatment or something. Don't panic that you're going to die.
Floating,
just relax. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess, you know, it's one of those weird properties. But I think people think, well, that's great, but that's something that we've all done in school or we've tried it at home. But what's the point of it?
Yeah. Do we have real world applications for stuff like this?
This is what I really love. So something as basic as cornflour mixed with water can actually save lives. I have to explain, though, how that works. So the fact that cornflour particles lock together on impact means that for that brief moment, they behave like a solid. So if on the point of impact, this material behaves like a solid, it's able to dissipate the impact of that energy across the material. So in doing so, if you were perhaps to, I don't know, shoot a bullet at this cornflour mixture, the energy of that impact would dissipate across the material, but it wouldn't penetrate through to the Tupperware. So we can use this principle for things like bulletproof armour.
Wow.
Now, cornflour itself is going to be sloshing about all over the place, but there are materials that you can embed into other materials like foams and fabrics that will then create the same properties, but can obviously be used in easier ways. So it's not quite a life-saving
So can we say cornflour is the new Kevlar?
Well, you can. This is the thing. So they are really trying to work with that. A little closer to home, perhaps. So I'm an overgrown child and I still do ballet. So it's hardly, you know, frontline fears to worry about there, but I do have to worry about point shoes. So point shoes are these really quite angular, quite painful shoes that you wear to go up on your tiptoes. I've got a traditional one here on the left, and it feels almost like a very tough papier-mâché thing that you want to put your feet into.
I can hear
now,
that. Yeah.
Obviously, that's quite painful, and if I tap it on the table here,
it's like a brick.
Hard. It's so painful. But brilliantly, what I recently discovered were non-Newtonian ballet shoes. So they are exactly the same. They're still point shoes, but you can hopefully, I mean,
I
those
can
of
see,
you that can
yeah.
see this, if I push down, this
squishy,
the traditional
a bit.
One is so, so tough, but this one is so much softer. And it's because the toe box is made of this foam embedded with what's called D3O, which is a non-Newtonian material, made by a company down in Brighton. So this bright orange goo has been embedded into the foam in the toe box and all along the shoe. So even though it's nice and soft and squishy to put my foot into, on impact, it's still really rock
hard.
So
when you're doing your leaps and jumps and stuff.
Mostly when you're on point. So when you're applying that force.
I suppose you've got
force,
the force of your whole weight on it.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have all the support that your foot would need to stay safe. You have all the strength to enable you to do those pirouettes on point. But they're so much more comfortable. So it's great. You know, not quite a life-saving application, but certainly saving
my
feet.
Saving, yes. And on that note, what is song number three?
That is a very good question. I'm just going to consult my list very, very quickly. So I've kind of gone for a mix of songs, actually. A lot of them are quite personal. Some of them are vaguely nerdy. The next one that I wanted to go for was The Ataris and I Owe You One Galaxy. Just to be super soppy, so my science communicating virologist fiance and I are getting married at the end of March. And
oh my God,
for
congratulations.
Some reason, thanks. I know it's going to be a vaguely nerdy wedding, of course. So one of the things I remember when I was young was hearing the Ataris, and I forget, you know, forgive me, it is basically punk pop that I've gone for here, but I remember thinking, like, love should be as normal and as simple and as natural as that feels. And so the words in this sort of really screamed to me, and I remember we'd been together about a year and it popped up on my iPod and I kind of went, oh my God, I've got that now. That's the love I've got. So yeah, this one's kind of going out there for Carl.
stars are out tonight, and you're the brightest one shining.
Sunscreen can contain nanoparticles of zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, which protect the skin from harmful UV light by absorbing and reflecting the light.
Now, I'm really interested in this artificial photosynthesis and kind of its future potential. So you said you work on getting water, getting the energy into the water. And what are you doing? What kind of materials are you using to capture that sunlight?
Almost like mirrors are in my mind. So titanium dioxide is one of the materials that I use. It's the predominant material, in fact, that I use. Reasons being that it's incredibly abundant. It's very, very cheap, and you can create it in lots of different ways. So I work with thin films of titanium dioxide, and they're made in the highly technical way of submerging a substrate into a beaker of this stuff and pulling it out. And as you pull it out, depending on the rate at which you pull it out, you can actually vary the thicknesses of the films that are deposited onto it. So if you take something out incredibly slowly, you can actually get something that is in sort of the tens of nanometer range of thinness of these films. So it's a solid gel process that I use. But titanium dioxide is used because of the fact that it can capture sunlight energy, and it can push that.
I guess
that
makes sense for why it's in sunblock.
Yeah, so it can reflect a lot of it, which is what you want to do, but also with the UV stuff as well. It can interact with UV light. So the way that I use that property of titanium dioxide is I encourage it to absorb that UV and push it onto the water molecules. The problem is that UV, ultraviolet, only makes up probably a couple of percent of all of the energy reaching us from the sun.
So we get heat energy as well, and we get all the different colours.
Exactly, yeah. So what we're trying to do is actually, you mentioned the colours, we're trying to push it up into the proportion of visible light. So UV, it has a very short wavelength, relatively, and it's very high energy. But what we're trying to do is manipulate the electronic properties of the titanium dioxide so that it can actually start to use these packets of light, these photons of light, of a slightly lower energy, so that we can utilize more of the solar spectrum. So it'll be kind of pushing it up into that rainbow of light that we see in. And it is lower energy, but by tweaking these properties, we should be able to do that. So we're increasing the efficiency of it. And the way that we do that is it's called altering the band gap. So it's the energy gap we need to overcome. And in order to do that, you need certain amounts of energy. So if we're reducing that, we're reducing the energy that's required to do that, pushing it into a slightly longer wavelength of the solar spectrum, utilizing more of it. And the way that we do that is by chucking a whole load of impurities into it effectively. So they're kind of gold and silver nanoparticles of a whole range of different things. And they interact with the material in such a way that they enable us to do that.
And to capture that wider range.
Yeah. So that's one way that we're trying to increase the efficiency of the process. And the other way, that seems sort of chemical to me, the other way is the physical way. We talked about lotus leaves and broccoli being difficult to wet, and it's all down to the microstructure. So one of the things that we're doing is trying to tweak the microstructure and the nanostructure of these materials so that we can increase the penetration of light into the material. Mm. We can increase the interface between the water and the material, and we can just keep ramping up the efficiency in all of these different ways.
Is it like kind of similar to trying to increase the surface area but on a really minute level?
Exactly that, yeah. And also creating these materials in a more porous way as well, because if you've got loads of holes there too, you can just start to get the light meeting more of the material in order for this process to happen.
And more of that reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is it like working in a scale that you can't even see?
It's great for me because I'm a chemist. So we put things into beakers or into vats in the right proportion, and the chemistry does the work for us. The challenge really is imaging. And another challenge, particularly when we're trying to make these physical sort of micro pillars and nano pillars, is finding ways of doing that, because obviously they can be quite delicate. Titanium dioxide itself is pretty robust, so we're lucky in that we've chosen a material that has the right properties for the things that we want to do with it, and that's a whole range of things that we can do with it. But I think the challenge always is, you know, actually looking at this material is pretty difficult, but there are so many awesome bits of kit out there that we can use. So a light microscope that we would use wouldn't really cut it on the nano scale, because light is actually quite a big thing to chuck at something in order to get an idea of what it looks like. So what we do is we use smaller particles. So we start to use subatomic particles, things like electrons, and we bombard materials with electrons. And there are a couple of different ways that we can image things. But effectively, rather than using bulky bits of light, we're using much smaller particles to do imaging and also sort of side effects of analysis as well.
Wow. Yeah. I think it must take such great imagination almost to be able to kind of look at images and be like, ah, that this is how it's working, even though you can't see it in like a physical form.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
I just love looking at some of these, like looking at anything on the micro scale and on the nano scale is amazing, because it's like some kind of alien world. All the things around us look so bizarre under a microscope. I kind of love it.
Yeah, even when you see like a picture of a hair and you're like, oh, it's like weird and spiky and flaky.
Yeah, it just looks really odd, doesn't it?
Doesn't look like the glossy, beautiful Pantene adverts. So there's a feature that we like to do each week called the fieldwork faux pas. Do you have any stories of times when your work has gone drastically wrong or embarrassingly wrong or anything like that?
Yes, very much. So one of the things I think it's important to say is that I'm so grateful and so lucky doing what I do at the moment. But I think people think that if you do a PhD or if you have done a PhD and you're an academic, that you were always top boffin in class, you were always the most focused. You know, I'm going to say now that was not the case with me. I was kind of nerdy, but never, you know, the cleverest. And I very much like going to gigs and going to bars. So, you know, I had a work-life balance very much as I was going through uni.
Yeah, I think that's really important.
Yeah, no, I think it is so, so important. But I also had a bit of a reputation back in my day of being an epic liability in a lab. So back at UCL Chemistry, we'd have rows and rows of these beautiful lab benches kitted out with everything you can imagine. And anytime we had an undergrad practical going on, if there was a crash, it was swiftly followed by what I can only describe as the sound of a Shetland pony, because it was usually me in my lab safe heels running away from said issue. So it was just a reputation that I managed to get. And even if something did crash, I would instinctively run, kind of going, but it wasn't me this time, it wasn't me.
Get away from the scene of the crime.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely wasn't me. I was nowhere near it. But, you know, despite that, I did have skills in practical chemistry and I worked hard on my exams, of course. And so I'm really lucky to do what I do. So I think that's one of the things. You don't have to be like the best at everything, because you will find your place in the area of work that you want to be doing. And if you have the right mentors, if you have the right personal tutors and things, they'll know what your skills are and they'll help you identify them. So that's really important. But the other thing that I really love is the fact that my old PhD supervisor, Professor Ivan Parkin at UCL, hello, he always used to call the things you want to do at the end of the day but don't really think you can justify doing them during the day, the 5:15 reactions. So it gets to about 5:15 in the afternoon, you go, I just want to try that thing. So it got to about 5:15 on a Friday. And I started doing a thing and thought, oh, I'm never going to get this done. I'm just going to leave it over the weekend. So I left over the weekend and I came back on Monday to this like green, gloopy thing. And I thought, well, I probably should have washed up better. I don't know what that is. But then I thought, well, you know, I'm a scientist because I want to experiment. So let's see what we've made. And so I did my dip coating and I created a material that I had not planned on creating.
Like a whole brand new material.
Yeah, but well, yeah, a thing that I hadn't
found in papers yet. And it turns out that it had really awesome properties. So it was a development of this that then led to us actually getting a patent on some of my PhD
work.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, chuck stuff into a beaker and hope for the best, because sometimes you'll find something you don't expect.
It's like, sounds to me like you invented flubber if it was green. And also, that's how penicillin came about, wasn't it?
So the many mold, things.
Yeah. And he just investigated the mold.
It's like penicillin. I think post-it note adhesive was an accident. Yeah. One of my favourites, we mentioned Kevlar earlier. Stephanie Kwolek kind of chanced upon this weird polymer mixture. Nobody wanted to spin the fibres from that because it just looked too gloopy. And she pushed and pushed. And what she ended up with were these fibers with amazing tensile strength. Wow. And like, they've saved, I think they'd sold 1 million bulletproof vests when she died 3 years ago. So she's potentially saved 1 million lives because she's like, well, this looks weird, let's try it. So that's what science is about.
So true. Time for song number 4.
Yeah, so I thought I would mix it up a little bit. Now, I do have a real love for the original version of this song, so I'm going to say it is Space Oddity. But the reason that I haven't gone for David Bowie's version is because I think we're really lucky at the moment because we're living in an era of real cheerleaders for STEM. I mean, I'm sat in a room with two amazing cheerleaders of STEM as it is. So, you know, what am I talking about? And I'm really proud to be part of this like army of people that are trying to share just how awesome science is, not just to kids and not just to the kids' parents, but to policymakers, to people across the world. It's so important, I think, now more than ever, that we do share what it is to be a scientist and the work that we're doing. When you think about people that are making decisions on our behalf, so politicians and policymakers, many of them are not scientifically trained. And I think there is this sense of, oh, I never liked science when I was in school. Oh, I had a terrible science teacher. And you think, well, that's devastating because you're missing out on this whole area of stuff that effectively taxpayers are funding. Get involved. But in order to do that, we have to start to foster better relationships with the public because they need to trust us. They need to know that we're just normal people that really like doing what we're doing. So the reason I have gone for Space Oddity by Chris Hadfield is because he is not only a great cheerleader of science, he's also, I think, nerdy enough and geeky enough to go, I really want to do this thing. I'm up in the International Space Station. I'm an astronaut and I really want to sing that Bowie song that I love. And he did it. And there was no agenda to it. It was just that joyful, I really want to do this thing. And in doing so, I think he's reached a whole new audience. And so the little, you know, cute STEM videos, so science, technology, engineering and maths videos that he was doing while he was up there and has continued to showcase have reached probably a wider audience because he's used something that people can understand and share
ground
with him, exactly, without ramming science in their face. So that's why I've gone for his, as a little celebration to him and all the other STEM cheerleaders out there, I've gone for his version of Space Oddity.
That's beautiful. I also urge anyone to go to YouTube and watch the video because it's really cool. He's floating around singing directly into the camera. We'll tweet it out on our Science Mixtape Twitter if you want to go there and find it.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. But it's time to guide the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. Left forevermore, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today, for here am I sitting in a tin.
Nanotubes, which are hollow carbon tubes of nanometer dimensions, can be used for drug delivery in the bloodstream. They can cage the drug and guide it to the cells in question.
News.
News. News. News.
News.
News just in. UN signals the end of throwaway plastic.
11-year-old Gitanjali Roy wins America's Top Scientist of the Year award.
NASA fires Voyager 1's engines for the first time in 37 years.
Scientists develop their first ever breathalyzer test for drugs.
A new 3D printed ink incorporating living bacteria can be used for a range of awesome applications.
Record-breaking 2-ton fish is the heaviest of its kind.
Amazing. Good range this week. I want to start by asking you, Miriam, about one of your stories.
Okay, so NASA sent out the Voyager 1 mission, so the lander, how many years ago? 37 years ago. And only recently, the backup thrusters have been put online. So they have been dormant for 37 years, and they've only just put it online because it's still sending out signals back. So it started out sending signals back in 1997, and still to this day, it's still sending signals because the antenna is still pointed towards Earth.
Where is it?
It's 13 billion light years away.
It's just out in space.
Miles away, yes, out in space.
Oh my God, and it's still sending us information.
Yes, and so they've put on the backup thrusters, and now for the next 7 years, it's still going to send out signals. So they're just making the most of that Voyager. And they're hoping to do this to Voyager 2 as well, and hoping that it will just last for more and more years so that we can keep getting information from space, which I think is really, really cool.
I can't even get my head around how far away that must be. That's so cool. Suze, who is this incredible 11-year-old?
Isn't it wonderful? So she has developed an app that can effectively detect lead levels in water. So I think she's based in Colorado. 11 years old, winning America's Top Young Scientist of the Year.
Wow.
But the beautiful thing about it is that the technology that she's created with, I think it was 3M that she was working with, it incorporates carbon nanotubes. We're so on brand, Miriam. I love it. We should do more together.
We didn't plan this, by the way.
Yeah, this is just a case of great minds. Thinks alike.
We really should do more together. So it incorporates that, but also it has an app that controls it and monitors what's going on. So not only is it a brilliant bit of physical technology in terms of the chemistry, this young lady has sort of taken that and worked with a whole range of different people to make it as accessible as
and
possible. Exactly.
And,
yeah. Oh,
wow. That gives me hope for the future, young
yes.
minds like that.
Yeah.
And this piece of news also, well, it gave me hope for the future when I saw the headline, which was UN signals the end of throwaway plastics, as we know, and as many who've watched the recent Blue Planet series will have seen, like, there's so much plastic in our seas, and it's killing so much of the wildlife, birds and fish and turtles as well. It's terrible. So UN ministers recently met in Kenya and signed off on a document stating that the flow of plastic into the ocean must be stopped. But that's about as far as it got. So they've all sort of agreed they're going to stop it, but there's no concrete actions yet. So after reading the whole article, I was a bit disappointed, but I suppose you have to start somewhere, and at least they are kind of recognising that it needs to change. It's going to be, I think it's going to be one of the major challenges for our generation, though, I think.
Definitely.
Stopping throwaway plastic. Yeah. Suze, moving swiftly on to song number 5.
Song number 5 is very selfishly by yet another band that I absolutely adore. The reason I've chosen Maximo Park and Book from Boxes is that it's one example of, I think, how the lead singer and all the band, but particularly Paul Smith as lead singer, looks around and reads about what's going on in the world and reflects on it in just a really beautiful way. I adore their lyrics, and I just haven't heard this in such a long time, and I wanted to share it with everyone.
I'm so pleased you did. This takes me right back. I love this song as well.
From the air, stadium lights stand out like flares, and all I know is that you're sat here right next to me. We rarely see warning signs in the air we breathe. Right now I feel each and every fragment. This paper trail leads right back to you. You say you need me to step outside. You spent the evening unpacking books from boxes. You passed me up so as not to break a promise. Scattered Polaroids and sprinkled words around your
your collar in the long run. You said you knew that this would happen.
Graphene is a nanostructure that is made of a single layer of carbon atoms that are arranged in a hexagonal lattice and is the world's first 2D material.
So we finished our news with a sort of sustainability challenge, and we have the same kind of challenges around energy and renewables and the work that you're doing. Do you think hydrogen is the future and the main way that we're going to solve that problem?
I think it could be one of the ways. It's based around solar energy. And I know that we have solar panels, but the difference is that a photovoltaic solar panel will gather that energy and convert it into electricity. So that's then stored in a battery. But until battery technology is better and until photovoltaic technology is better, we're kind of limited as to how much we can really do
it's
with
true,
it.
It's true, yeah. The ability to store electricity is a real problem at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. But there is a great factoid where the amount of solar energy reaching us on Earth in 1 hour could meet current global energy demands for an entire year. Now, a lot of that is quite difficult to capture, but maybe using the technology that I'm developing and teams all over the world are developing within this area of artificial photosynthesis and of water splitting, we can start to really contribute to that. So we can start to gather more and more of that energy and potentially have a really viable alternative to petrol in cars. We can start to fill our cars up with water. We can start to run our homes with just water tanks on the roofs rather than photovoltaics. But it doesn't stop there. The thing I love about this kind of technology of creating hydrogen just from water and a bit of light using an awesome material to do it is the fact that we're looking constantly towards other planets. You know, where are we going to be in 5 years or 10 years? Mm. And we have these Martian missions that are being developed. The thing is, it takes so much energy to get fuel out there. So what we're probably not going to be doing as humans is carrying a whole bunch of fuel out there.
Yeah, because it's so heavy.
To then get us back. Yeah, think about the energy required to do that. The fuel you'd need to take that fuel out just wouldn't be worth it. But if we can have water, if we can start to recycle the water that we have, that we've taken out there, that we've been using, and I mean using and probably reusing, people, because we're going to have to do that if we're going somewhere where there isn't an abundance of water. What we will then need to do is convert that water potentially into hydrogen to then burn that to get us back to Earth. So I think that's why I just love the fact that it's not just the local and sort of global applications. It's this sort of interplanetary potential that this
really
has.
It really is kind of opening doors. It's broadening horizons. I mean, I say it is. We're not there yet, but watch this space because that sounds so cool.
Fingers crossed. If NASA are listening. Hi.
And before we leave today, it's time to answer our brain teaser. So Miriam, has anybody guessed it correctly?
Okay, so just to remind you, the brain teaser was, what is the thinnest material in the world? So Tom tweeted us in and he said it's graphene, and it is. So it's a 2D material, so it's really, really thin.
Congratulations, Tom. Well done. Yes, it is indeed graphene. Suze, what is going to be the final song of your mixtape?
My final song is, again, purely selfish. It actually is my favourite band in the world. Hashtag Suze loves Muse. I do love Muse because they're epically nerdy as well, but they have such a range of different songs and genres that they use. And there were many that I could choose from that had a sort of scientific slant to them. There's Knights of Cydonia looking at Mars. There's
Supermassive
Black Hole. There's Neutron Star Collision, the sort of nerdiest love song. But I've gone for my second favourite Muse song ever, which is Stockholm Syndrome, to take us out.
Thank you so much. It's been such a fun show.
Thank you for having me.
For more Science Mixtape,
You can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.